Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Interesting finding from the Pew Research Center today. Did you see this? Social media users are less likely to express their opinions on Facebook or Twitter if they think many of their followers will disagree with them. And regular Facebook users were less likely than non-Facebook users to express dissenting opinion, even when meeting people face-to-face. Pew's theory on that, people very into social media are especially sensitive to their social context, including the political views of the people they surround themselves with, so they may be less likely to risk alienating people by disagreeing with them face-to-face or online. So listeners, what do you think? Use our social media pages to discuss whether Facebook and Twitter lock you into your friends' and followers' points of view, at least for what you're willing to write on those platforms. Tweet at Brian Lehrer on Twitter or go to facebook.com/BrianLehrerWNYC where we posted this question. My next guest is a persistent critic of polarized, brain-dead opinion media, John Avlon, executive editor of The Daily Beast, CNN contributor and author of the book Wing Nuts, Extremism in the Age of Obama, which is just out in paperback. Hi, John. Welcome back to WNYC.
Great to be with you, Brian.
And I don't know if you've seen that Pew finding yet, but how much did you already think politics on the internet is closing people's minds rather than opening them?
You know, the polarization we've seen, which is at an unprecedented level in our recent history, is definitely compounded by the rise of partisan media and in the web, to the extent to which that people can segregate themselves by news outlets that conform their own political biases and prejudices. And then it creates these sort of mini echo chambers. And what's fascinating is social media, which has the opportunity to connect us all in different ways, just like the internet does, we end up giving into these herd mentality impulses that then can quickly gallop to mob mentality. And that's where a lot of the ugliness and the groupthink comes from that really exacerbates the polarization we're wrestling with.
And the Pew study is interesting. They used Edward Snowden's revelations as their test issue because they knew the public was about evenly divided on whether Snowden did a good thing by leaking them. And they found what they called a spiral of silence among social media users when it came to expressing their opinion of Snowden if they thought most of their friends or followers would disagree. So on first blush, because I know you're hearing this about Snowden for the first time as I'm saying it, do you think this contributes to the rise of extremism and polarization that you write about in the book?
I think certainly polarization. I mean, whenever there's groupthink, you know, the old line that in a place where everyone thinks alike, no one's thinking very much, that's one of the main fuels and drivers of polarization, because it does take people who are independent-minded to sort of bridge those gaps and to reshuffle the coalitions. And it's the thing we have least of in our politics right now. And you know, from a media perspective, the rise of partisan media is one of the real driving forces and the way it's being pushed by technology in new ways. But it's, I mean, you know, two decades ago, politicians gave talking points to talk radio. Now it's, you know, the exact opposite. And that's a dangerous driver of a discord today.
And yet there you are trying to run an alternative, in a sense, as editor of The Daily Beast. And I have to say, I still have hope for the internet as a potentially moderating influence as well as polarizing influence. There's so much information at our fingertips. There's actually so much disagreement, even if a lot of it is coarsely stated or stated in polarized ways. People are publicly disagreeing with each other on our site, on CNN's site where you do some work, so many places, smart media like your Daily Beast and The Atlantic and other things these days that get widely shared are not the most polarized because they would be too predictable as a marketing strategy. So I'm just defending what I still think is the potential for viral nuance in the digital sphere, and I wonder what you think.
I completely agree. Look, I'm an optimist, and you know, as Abraham Lincoln once said, I'm an optimist because I don't see the point in being anything else. But I do think that these fevers break over history. I mean, you know, if you look at the parallel moments we've had, some of the echoes of the ugliest stuff, the fever breaks. The wingnut leaders ultimately depose themselves. And what we're trying to do at the Daily Beast is definitely not become part of that, you know, partisan cheerleading crowd, but to live by the idea that you can be nonpartisan without being neutral. That means not falling into the, on the one hand, on the other hand, equivalency, but really, you know, punching left and right, as the case may be, representing a full spectrum of civil debate, columnists who range from liberal to libertarian, and that ultimately expresses more respect for the reader's intelligence and their time. And I think that's a long-term winning strategy. I think when you look at the decrease in trust in media, it comes from the predictable hyperpartisanship. And millennials in particular are sick of it. They're demanding something different. So there's an opportunity to provide something different as long as you stand for something and plant that flag.
I agree with all of that. And listeners, if you want to talk to John Avalon, if you know his work, his book Wing Nuts, his work on Daily Beast or CNN, or talk about this question of whether you have pause before you post something on Twitter or Facebook that you think most of your friends or followers disagree with, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. I was looking for whether you practice what you preach. And my conclusion after about a 5-minute browse of Daily Beast this morning was yes.
Well,
because I saw your top politics story this morning has the headline, Why Killer Cops Walk Free. Why Killer Cops Walk Free. Now, that sounds like it makes a strong statement suggesting that more cops in cases like Eric Garner and Michael Brown should go to prison. But you have another piece with a photo of Al Sharpton that argues there is no such thing as the black community. So those are, you know, the people who reflexively agree with one would probably not reflexively agree with the other. What are you trying to say having those two featured pieces?
That's a great example of what we try to do at the Daily Beast and we do every day. I think predictability is a huge sin in media because it does sort of reinforce this self-segregation that's occurring. So we want to put forward strong voices making reasoned arguments that are from a passionate place that can kind of that shake up the coalitions, the predictability of partisan media. And since I became editor-in-chief of the Daily Beast, I mean, I began as a columnist there, then political director. So I come at this from a political perspective. But I really do believe that if you give people a strong alternative, if you shake up their assumptions, if you offer reasoned cases, often you can find amazing new coalitions. You'll find places where libertarians agree with liberals. That's a fascinating new development in our politics. And we should be trying to challenge people's assumptions, call BS, frankly, because that's one of the things we really need to do on the demagogues that are out there in politics and media, and then find a way to build bridges, because ultimately the American people are smart. Ultimately, they really do deserve something better, and they want something different.
John in Richfield Park, you're on WNYC. Hello, John.
Hi, Brian. How you been?
Okay.
You mentioned a little earlier, you said you were hopeful of viral nuance. And the problem that we have, especially on something like Facebook, is nuance is the biggest casualty because the structure of that is not for the promotion or dissemination of facts or even information, but to garner clicks. Mm-hmm. So it's basically peer-to-peer yellow journalism. You go down your feed and you see suggested posts that say something like Hillary Clinton or, you know, Boehner was asked about baby killing, and
right.
They say will surprise you, you know, and you go there.
But I think both, since you posed the question to me, I think both things are true, that what you just said is undeniably true. But at the same time, Facebook is a place where people go to engage with their friends. Mm. And that's more of a real person, likely to include nuance kind of interaction. And I can tell you, John Avalon, that from our experience, the comments that we get on our Facebook page tend to be much more nuanced than the comments that we get on our traditional comments page at WNYC.org.
Sure.
And I think it's something about the nature of Facebook that is conducive to nuance.
Well, we're all pioneers in emerging different media right now, and we see there are differences between Facebook and Twitter and certainly comments. One of the reasons a lot of sites have moved away from comment sections is we've found that essentially when people don't have to own their speech by putting forward their real name, they're much more liable to sort of give into that reptile mind and be incredibly ugly and say things they would never say person to person, face to face. Facebook is a much more inspirational, aspirational kind of sharing. It's much more conducive to long reads, whereas Twitter is much more of a closed loop on news feeds. So this is all stuff that's happening in real time. But those of us who are running websites and we're running shows, we've got a choice. You know, you can do the sugar high, play to the base approach to gaining traffic and clicks. You can do that all day long, and you'll get a short-term bump. out. But in the long run, I think you sell yourself short, you sell your audience short. The more difficult, interesting way to do it is to try to promote a constructive conversation that's exciting and interesting and says that news doesn't need to taste like medicine. We have two rules at the Daily Beast. Don't be boring and don't be stupid. That's our edit rules.
Lauren in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you for making it.
No problem. I just wanted to say that for me, I think the hesitation to bring up controversial issues is something that didn't start with social media. You know, I would be hesitant to bring up something, you know, in a group of friends if I felt like it might offend people.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I tend to carry that over, you know, onto Facebook or, you know, Instagram or whatever.
So that's more an extension of real life than a creation of it.
Maybe I'm too timid, but also to the point about people tending to react in ways, you know, when they're behind the computer screen that they might not normally. Like, you know, sometimes I don't want the hassle if I know, you know, my friend's libertarian boyfriend is going to, like, let loose, you know, if I post something about national
security. Right, because people feel more uninhibited about flaming you back, right?
Even
harass, you know, there are all these stories about internet harassments. I mean, look at poor Zelda Williams, Robin Williams' daughter.
Absolutely.
And what did she do to anybody?
And this is where that sort of mob mentality really can emerge. But the caller brings up something important. I think it's a challenge to all of us, and it's one of the things that actually drove me to write Wingnuts in the first place. You know, those of us who are in the center, I'm a proud centrist. I believe it's a principled position. I'm an independent, but I get the mushy middle stereotype. And the problem is that too many folks in the moderate majority of Americans they see the extremes sucking up all the oxygen. All the screamers disproportionately dominate the debate. And so we feel like we're a minority. And really what's necessary is to actually straighten your civic backbone and begin to engage the conversation. It was the idea behind Jon Stewart's Rally to Restore Sanity. You know, if the people who have lives who are busy feel that politics is a place that just for the extremes, then they win and our democracy loses.
Lauren, I want to thank you for your candor and your nuance actually right in that call. And my guest is Jon Avalon, executive editor of The Daily Beast.
Editor-in-chief,
author of Wing Nuts, Extremism in the Age of Obama, now out in paperback. I saw that you wrote up that Jon Stewart rally in the book, reminding people that they were holding signs there that said things like, I may disagree with you, but I don't think you're Hitler.
Yeah, exactly. so much has happened in the 4 years since the book first came out that it really kind of demanded an update from Occupy to the 2010 election to the kamikaze caucus that hijacked the Congress and to Republicans getting a degree of comeuppance and fascinating things like the guy who started the Sarah Palin for President draft expressing disappointment. Two girls from the Westboro Baptist Church who I interviewed having left the church saying, you know, we didn't
that
know.
That radical group.
Yeah.
That's not a regular Baptist church.
Yeah, exactly right. So there's just, you know, so much has happened in the last 4 years, and it really kind of completed the story arc as well as allowed me to do a fun chapter on the history of extremism in America, which provides a lot of background to all the noise we hear.
Is there a difference for you between a moderate and a centrist?
There is. I mean, it's partly linguistic, but I think the difference is I think the radical center implies a degree of decisiveness and forward momentum. You know, the old idea that you're not moving left and right, but forward. I think too often moderates got stereotyped as people who are simply split the difference, people who are not actually interested in moving the ball forward of the debate, who are satisfied with the status quo. And in fact, the vast majority of folks in the center, I think, are demanding something different. You know, many are fiscally conservative but socially liberal libertarian, and I think it represents a rising tide and something very different in politics that the millennial generation embodies. But unless we offer a strong alternative, we'll just keep getting disproportionately drowned out by the folks in the far right and far left who aren't actually representative of the American character. Ultimately.
You're a big Michael Bloomberg fan, aren't you?
I worked for Rudy Giuliani, believe it or not. I was his chief speechwriter. But Mike Bloomberg's politics and I overlap considerably, not entirely. What's the old Ed Koch line? You know, agree with me 9 times out of 10, vote for me. Vote agree with me 10 times out of 10, see a psychiatrist.
Right.
So there's not a perfect overlap. But I think Mike Bloomberg and I think those 20 years were great for the city.
How about Andrew Cuomo? He's got both the right and the left pretty inflamed in New York State these days.
He does. I mean, I do think the way that, you know, let's put aside the current scandals and I think the interesting seminar, both positive and negative, about how you tame Albany and how compromised that our capital is. I think the way he's tacked left on many social issues, from marijuana on down, but also tried to hold a strong line on taxes and balanced budgets. You know, that was one of the reasons he's had such a sky-high popularity rating, despite a high unemployment rate. But it's interesting. I think Christie and Cuomo are cut from similar cloths, despite being from different parties. But you see some of that, the downside that comes with a strong leadership style, coming back to bite him.
Do you think Cuomo stands for anything? I'm putting you on the spot here as a political commentator. But, I mean, his moderation is seen by his critics often as being only about cultivating his own power. Unlike Bloomberg, who really stands as a moral force, whether you agree with him or not, on his various issues, be it, you know, gun control or pro-business, you're like, Michael Bloomberg really believes this stuff. With Cuomo, the suspicion always is he's doing whatever it takes to make him politically more powerful.
It's a bit more transactional. Look, I can easily see that criticism of Andrew Cuomo. I do think, though, in the short run, he's been able to tame Albany and make it work in a way that hasn't been the case in several decades. So while I think there's a pragmatism that drives his centrism as opposed to a principled coalition building, I think he probably deserves more credit than he's getting at the current moment, given all the smoke. We'll see his continued commitment to issues like election reform. Is that purely expedient, or is it something he's willing to trade away?
Rajul in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi.
Hi there.
I was calling in response to your earlier question about whether I don't post certain things on Facebook.
Right. Opinions that you think your friends will by and large disagree with?
The big point before I make my comment is that many people who have friends on Facebook, those friends aren't actually friends. They're often acquaintances. And there is a tendency for some people to actually friend a huge number of people,
right,
many of whom one knows very cursorily. So, you know, I have a few friends like that who I know, but they're not actually my friends. And I had a situation where I posted something which was political, I have to say, but, you know, these people who responded, they weren't able to respond in a way that I would expect, meaning in having a rational debate,
mm-hmm.
and it became more inflamed than I would like. And so now, you know, after that incident, I decided, okay, I think I better steer clear.
You got burned.
Talking about certain things.
You got burned. Yeah,
yeah.
That's a really interesting story, and I think instructive for a lot of people. Thank you for sharing it. Do you see wing nuttiness, since your book is Wing Nuts, Extremism in the Age of Obama, do you see wing nuttiness in the age of Obama to be much different than in the age of Bill Clinton? We had the militia movement, the Vince Foster murder conspiracy theories, which we refer to in the book.
Mm-hmm.
You know a lot of it. And I tend to see the Obama haters and the Tea Party's truest believers, let's say, as largely a continuation of that same strain of right-wing populism because,
mm-hmm.
you know, our eyes were bugging out in the 90s saying, I can't believe how polarized everything is. This reflexive hate Bill Clinton movement, all of that.
Yeah, look, it's a great and important point. And it's one of the reasons why one of the new chapters in this edition is about the history of extremism in America. There are absolutely common denominators. If you go back and look at the history of wingnuts in America, from even the Washington founding father era, which we gloss over through.
You have a great George Washington quote at the end of the book.
You
want to share it?
Sure, from the farewell address. I'll work my way up to that. But, you know, when you realize that Glenn Beck's antics are really just updates, conscious or not, of the John Birch Society, you see these common themes: ethnic and racial suspicion, religious suspicion, the us against them appeals, claims of subversion of our sovereignty by foreign powers. And the granddaddy is always that the president of the United States is trying to undo the Constitution and is a would-be tyrant. When you look at that progress, you see these common themes. And one of the important reasons it's important to know our history is so when you hear the arguments, you understand the antecedents and you're quicker to call it out for appealing to that reptile mind in predictable ways. The Clinton era we thought was bad. And absolutely, the militias turned into the hatriots of this decade. Massive growth in the militia movement. The Southern Poverty Law Center has done heroic work documenting this stuff. What's so ironic, and I think a teachable moment, to use an Obama phrase, is the way that that after Bill Clinton left the White House, all of a sudden, his most obsessive critics, like Christopher Ruddy, who was a journalist who investigated, who now runs Newsmax, now says he was a great president. Richard Mellon Scaife, who funded a lot of the projects against him.
Symbolically, he was the Koch brothers of that time.
Absolutely. And when he passed away, you know, he was a major donor to Clinton Global Foundation, a Global Initiative. He counted Bill and Hillary Clinton as friends. Clinton spoke at his funeral. So it's a way in which we need to understand that perspective is the thing we have least of in our politics, but it's essential to having a constructive civic debate. And when you look back at all those inflamed passions that were all based on nothing but really hate and reflexive hyperpartisanship, we should all realize that the obsessive hyperpartisans today are likely to look no better. That ultimately Bill Clinton was more or less what he said he would. Is he a flawed human being? Sure. But he basically was a centrist Southern governor. And ultimately, people in the presidency are trying to do the best job they can. And when we give in to these impulses, these conspiratorial impulses that Richard Hofstadter called the paranoid style in American politics, it's almost always wrong, folks. You're always going to look foolish and unloved and idiotic and guilty of trying to inflame the worst passions. And it is something that George Washington spoke about in his farewell address.
And I'll let you end with that in a minute. But do you remember during the 2008 primaries that one of the arguments for Obama against Hillary Clinton was that Hillary is so divisive historically that people would divide into camps because they always did, pro-Clinton, anti-Clinton, and Obama had the potential, or if we didn't have a Clinton in the White House, we had the potential for a much more unified electorate, and if anything, it got worse.
Well, first of all, I mean, you know, race, you know, slavery being the original sin in the American experience, race has cropped up. And that is one way that the criticism of this president is fundamentally different than past presidents. But I do also think that Hillary Clinton is a much less polarizing figure now than she was in 2008. First of all, we've had a break in the Bush-Clinton thing. And also, I think her experience as Secretary of State. But it does show you, I mean, Barack Obama introduced himself to the nation as there are no red states, there are no blue states, there are the United States 10 years ago. And so quickly, and I think as a matter of self-conception, he's always been a bridge builder between worlds.
And yet he couldn't avoid this.
Because the buzzsaw and the people who are invested financially and politically in perpetuating polarization were so powerful with the added animus of race. And we'll see it again. Look, Hillary Clinton, like Bill Clinton, it's ironic that for times they've in recent years become Republicans' favorite Democrat. Well, guess what, folks? A lot of the old stuff's going to come back. But the difference is we should be able to call BS a little bit quicker. Because we've seen it.
George Washington.
Yeah, Washington. I'm actually, the next book I'm working on down the road is about his farewell address. And this quote is from his farewell address. And basically, Washington in his two terms was beset, the birth of the hyperpartisan press. He was a member of no parties. There was a lot of intrigue, even in his own cabinet. And his farewell address focused on three incredibly prescient themes. His warning to future generations. He warned about the dangers of what we would call hyperpartisanship. He warned about the dangers of excessive debt and foreign wars. But when he talked about the dangers of hyperpartisanship, he talked about the dangers of demagogues who agitate the community with ill-founded jealousies and false alarms, kindling the animosity of one part against the other. People who serve to organize faction and give it an artificial and extraordinary force to put in the place of the delegated will of the nation, the delegated will of a party. And he warned that the alternate domination of one faction over the other, sharpened by the spirit of revenge, which is natural to party dissension, in different ages and different countries has perpetrated the most horrid enormities and is itself a frightening despotism. So George Washington warned us about the way
that's quotes. George Washington gives me goosebumps to hear that he said that in the 1700s.
1796.
Could have said it on CNN's Crossfire if he had the middle seat last week. John Avlon's farewell address, by quoting George Washington's farewell address there as we come to the end of this segment. John Avlon, A-V-L-O-N, is editor-in-chief of The Daily Beast and author of Wingnuts, Extremism in the Age of Obama, now out in paperback. Thanks.
Thank you, Brian.